Shalom and welcome to On the House, the podcast where industry experts and professionals discuss real estate in Israel. I'm your host, Debbie Goldfischer, real estate agent, founder and editor-in-chief of buyitinisrael.com. Join us as we explore market trends, legal and tax issues, purchasing tips, neighborhoods throughout Israel, and much more. All this is On the House, helping you make the right move. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us for the fifth and final episode of this season, dedicated to mortgages in Israel. Throughout the season, we've covered almost everything you need to know about taking a mortgage in Israel, particularly for foreign residents and new olim. We've explored the various mortgage tracks, options, and variables. We've discussed the mortgage application process, eligibility, refinancing, early repayments, and penalties. We've even had a bank representative offer insights from the bank's perspective. Additionally, we touched on the Israeli market with a focus on its unique challenges for foreign buyers. Over the past month, we've been overwhelmed by the incredible interest and volume of questions and comments we received. While we've tried to address as much as possible, we know it's impossible to answer everyone. So we've curated a list of the most repeated, relevant, and important questions to address today. For this special episode, I am thrilled to welcome Aaron Krasner, a British-born mortgage broker. We literally grew up on the same street in Northwest London. Aaron is the owner and senior mortgage broker at his firm, Anglo Mortgages, bringing over 14 years of experience working exclusively with English-speaking clients to help them secure financing from Israeli banks and secondary lenders. Aaron is a true expert in the field, having processed a significant volume of both residential and commercial mortgages. Over the years, he's built strong working relationships with all major banks, but what truly sets Aaron apart is his ability to simplify complex and unfamiliar issues, making them easy to understand for his clients. He's known for being pleasant, hardworking, highly responsive, and exceptionally organized, a professional that I often turn to when I have questions. Aaron has also contributed numerous insightful articles on the Buy It in Israel website, sharing his expertise to educate and guide buyers through the process. With that, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be with you.
Before we dive in, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got into the mortgage business in Israel?
We bought a house in Israel when I was quite young, and we had a mortgage broker guide us through the process, and I was quite disappointed with the level of service that I got. And I thought to myself, you know, this is probably something which I could do myself. So I called up Nefesh B'Nefesh, and they put me in touch with a great company called Mortgage Israel, which is where I ended up working for about 13 years. And they trained me in the process, and slowly but surely we built it up into, you know, great business.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love that. So you turned around an opportunity.
Yeah, it was a real nightmare actually getting my mortgage at the time. In other words, we were very young. I needed help from my father to co-sign on the loan. And because there was some mix-up and I didn't properly understand the contract, I was very young at the time, 23 or something like that. I didn't fully understand the contract. Then in the end, we had to get my dad to fly out, and it was a big, you know, to come out to Israel quickly, and it was a whole balagan. And it was really an unpleasant process. But
And that inspired you to do what you
exactly,
do.
Fantastic. Exactly. So I started helping mortgages for my friends who were at similar situations and guiding them through, and having seen what didn't work for me, I saw what worked for them. And all my business is more or less, you know, sort of Pella Ozen. It's, you know, referrals. The whole industry works that way. People refer their friends. You know, people choose a mortgage broker most often from, you know, referrals of people who have used them already.
Sure.
And so that's how it started. Yeah. Sure.
So we see, as always, Hakol Tova. Everything is for a good reason. Even though you had a bad experience, it's taken you to the right place.
Absolutely.
And today you are independent. You have your own business.
That's right. So in 2000 and I believe 2021, I think I set up Anglo Mortgages, and we do exactly what it's, you know, what we do exactly that. Anglo Mortgages. It's English speaking clients, people who have lived here in Israel for many, many years, or who live abroad all over the world.
Beautiful.
Anywhere where anyone whose English is their first language and wants to buy a property in Israel, like those are the people
that's
that we're servicing.
Do. Fantastic. And, you know, you are, if I'm not mistaken, the fourth mortgage broker that we brought on. I tried to bring on, first of all, different types of people, different nationalities, all different personalities, so that people get exposure to all different types. And obviously everybody has a different way of working and a different angle. what would you say are the skill sets that are needed for this profession?
It's a good question. So the way I look at it is I'm kind of a buffer between a certain type of client, an Anglo client, and an Israeli bank. So an Anglo client's got a certain mindset. They're used to doing business, you know, the English way or the American way or the French way or the Australian way. And that's not the same as the way Israeli bankers work and think. Sometimes, you know, whenever I invite a client into the bank, I always make sure I'm there with them. Sometimes one time, I invited the client into the bank. I just said, just sit with this banker to open the bank account and, you know, I'll be back in half an hour. I came back half an hour later and there's like screaming going on, this person's offended. It wasn't the Israeli banker's fault and it wasn't the client's fault. It's just, there's a different expectations and there's different ways of communicating and understanding. I think you know what I'm talking about.
So now you stay with the client.
So I do. So in other words, so one skill set is to kind of, sort of on the client end to guide them through the process, to make sure that you're seeing around corners, to explain things calmly, nicely, provide a structure to get it through this process and make it as easy as possible. So that's one skill set. But then on the other end, it's the bank end, which is, you've got to be tough and you've got to be able to push for the benefits of your clients. You've got to advocate for them. And, in the same way that a lawyer sort of fights for his clients against the other side, so to speak, against the counterparty. So I'm fighting for my clients with the bank. So on the one hand, you've got to be sort of tough on the bank end, but you've also got to be very, very calm and cool and patient on the client end. So,
which you certainly are.
Thank you.
Fantastic. So that brings me actually to one of the questions that that was submitted. And somebody was asking, what qualifications and requirements must a mortgage broker in Israel meet?
In other words, to practice professionally, you mean?
Right? Exactly.
Yeah. So it's not a super regulated industry. In fact, when I started out, the banks were quite hostile to mortgage brokers. They didn't really understand who we were, what we were doing. They were like, you're not the client. Why am I speaking to you? And I had to bring an explanation. I'm a mortgage broker and so forth. About 8 or 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly, there was something called the Hitachdut Yoatzei Mashkanta, the mortgage broker union started.
Okay.
So that's an organization that is basically, their job is to professionalize the industry. So they don't have, I think there's a qualification that you have to meet in order to join the union, but I'd been practicing beforehand, so I just kind of was grandfathered in. So there is a qualification to join the union, and there's an idea to try and professionalize things up. But in theory, if you've got the skills to do it, and you've got the clients that can help you, it's not like a lawyer that you have to get a
professional.
Yeah, a professional qualification to do it. But being part of the union is very helpful. And for that, there is some type of qualification. So, sure. But truth be told, like on some level, you kind of live and die on your skill set. So if you have the skills to do it, you'll do very well. And if you don't have the skills to do it, then it doesn't go.
Sure. And as you said, most of the business comes pele ozen, from mouth to ear. It's word of mouth.
Exactly.
Word of mouth.
Exactly. So most of the people I'm speaking to, generally speaking, I'm kind of, so to speak, pre-screened, because either they've seen me on a webinar or they've heard me. And so you get a sense of somebody's competency reasonably quickly.
Mm-hmm. You know, something that I was thinking about as I was interviewing these various different brokers or mortgage consultants is the role of AI. I mean, I've started to use AI for so many things. It's unbelievable.
Right.
It's changed my life. In fact, I have to say, this is sort of a funny but not so funny story. My son, who's in the army, who went in August 23, he was home, Baruch Hashem, for a few days, a couple of weeks ago, and he came over to me. I was working at my desk, and he said, Mommy, you're busy. What are you doing? And I said, and I showed him, I said, I'm using ChatGPT for something.
Right.
He said, what? I said, ChatGPT. You know, it's amazing. It's changed the world. He said, well, what is that? What is it?
You didn't know.
And I suddenly realized his life is frozen. He's hardly been home.
Wow.
And he's dedicated his life to the army, and he has no idea what ChatGPT is. And I showed him, and he was like, his eyes were popping out of his head. But he still has really no idea to what extent AI is changing the world.
Absolutely.
And
including the army.
Including the army, absolutely. And as I've been talking to various different mortgage brokers, talking about the way that they determine what tracks to put their clients on, what strategy is most suitable, I'm thinking, just put it all into ChatGPT and tell right. and he'll tell you what the best selections would be.
Right.
Now, obviously, there's nothing like human intervention.
Right.
But do you use AI in your work? And if so, how? And, you know, what do you right. see the future?
If you mean technology has changed the way I do my work very significantly, not necessarily AI so much yet. Even just at the banks, some banks now do the signing, which used to be an hour with the client sitting in the bank waiting for their turn and so on and so forth. They do that over Zoom now.
Right.
So in other words, the signing is they'll say, get the clients, you know, we'll send them the documents onto their smartphone.
Right.
We'll sign you over Zoom. We just have to put your tutsahut into the screen. And that's how they do it. It's a much faster process. It's much easier. If a client's in the north of the country and the bank is in Yerushalayim or the south of the country, it doesn't matter so much anymore.
Sure, makes sense.
So technology definitely makes a big difference. And also in terms of like the technical registration of stuff, it used to be that if I was doing a mortgage, we'd have to actually physically go to the land registry to register the mortgage. Mm. We'd physically have to go to the mortgage registry to register the charge. So that kind of stuff now a lot more is done online. Mm-hmm. And a lot more technologies are moving in that way.
I'm sure. But AI, I'm thinking like put in 42-year-old guy.
Yeah.
Who is buying his first home
right.
in Israel. He works as a lawyer. He earns this much per month and his wife is a part-time whatever,
right.
earning this much. They have four children. Their house is worth this much. They're putting down X amount down payment. How should we structure their mortgage?
Right.
And I haven't tried it, but I'd be interested to know what ChatGPT or another AI platform comes back with.
So I'm running algorithms in my own head when I'm speaking to clients to try and think, you know, as I'm listening to them, I'm thinking like, okay, so, you know, how much should we get fixed and how much should we put variable, et cetera. So I'm taking in the factors. But the way I decide to structure loans is there's no right answer. You can't mm-hmm. say like in this person's situation the correct answer is X, because we don't know the future. If we knew that interest rates were going to go flying up, we'd say okay, we fixed the entire loan. Mm-hmm. If we knew that interest rates were going down, etc., if we knew that they were going to be getting a raise in 2 years, or we knew they were going to be losing their jobs in 2 years, but we, you know, I don't think that AI can, you know, it might be able to put a statistical likelihood of those things happening, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. So what I like to try to do is I like to lay out the options as clearly as I can to the clients. And I tell them, I encourage them to, once we've seen a couple of options, tell me, what does your gut feeling resonate with as the best risk profile over here? In other words, some of my clients that I speak to, they're like, absolutely, why on earth would anybody do anything other than a fixed rate? Because that way you get rid of the risk of interest rates going up. And there are other clients saying, who on earth in their right mind, why would anybody take a fixed rate at 5% today when 2 years ago I could get a fixed rate at 2.8? That's crazy. So I say to them, like, I understand what you're saying, you know, and there's different types of personality. So the one thing which I try to do with everybody is understand the options, understand the pros and cons. And if what's resonating with you is option 3 out of 5, then option 3 out of 5 is what's right for you, because mm-hmm. your gut feeling is your algorithm, you know, your internal AI telling you, this is what's going to help me sleep best at night. This is what's going to fit my situation. I kind of think that this is most likely. We're making all these calculations in the back of our heads. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel like an AI could necessarily, you know, take all that on. Like, mm-hmm. for example, if you think about, you know, I use AI a lot, like for like, let's say, you know, my washing machine broke or my microwave broke. So, you know, I quickly look on ChatGPT saying like, this is the model, how do you fix it? So, and if it's relatively easy, I'm like, oh, okay, that's great. You know, so now I don't need to bother, you know, to bother spending 500 shekel on a plumber. But if it gets like even that little bit more complicated, I'm like, okay, screw this. Like I need to call yeah, a plumber.
Right.
So I think on some level, like if you're the kind of person who's like, okay, I would go to the bank by myself and I just need to know, like, is the best possible rate 5 or 4.92 or mm-hmm. maybe an AI could help with that and gather the information and check all check out all the rates and then could tell you, yeah, actually really the best you could do is 4.92. But in the real world, you know, all these devices like email and all that kind of stuff that speeds up our lives and makes things quicker, we still delegate lots of stuff to professionals. And I don't Absolutely. See that changing
right.
even for another, you know, even as we adapt to AI coming in, mm-hmm. I still think that people are going to be delegating jobs to professional service people for quite a while.
Absolutely, I agree. The way I look at AI is that it enhances what we do. It improves what we do.
Yeah.
and allows us to do it even better.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take away the work
exactly.
that we're doing.
Exactly.
So let's go through these questions. I'm trying to figure out what order we should go in and how we should do it, but I'm going to just start right here.
Let's dive in.
Can I use part of my mortgage for renovations or to cover additional costs like taxes and fees?
Great question. So I'm assuming that we're talking about somebody who's buying a new house, not an existing property. So on a new house, when you're borrowing money against the house and that money's going to the seller, so that house doesn't yet belong to you. So all the borrowing that you're doing at that particular stage has to be only and specifically for money which is going to the seller, and you can't borrow against the house for things like purchase tax or realtors or lawyers and stuff like that. What you can do is when you're taking a mortgage, you need to have a bank account. Often if you're a foreign resident, you're probably opening a bank account in order to facilitate the mortgage taking place. So you can get a loan into that account. In other words, when you open up a bank account at the same time and get a 200,000, 300,000, 500,000 shekel side loan, mm-hmm. that can be used, it's not secured against the property, mm-hmm. that can be used to cover expenses and stuff.
But the rates are going to be significantly more.
The rates are a bit higher, and more importantly, the loan term is shorter. So instead of doing a 30-year loan or a 20-year loan, you're doing like a 12-year loan. So it's a much higher monthly repayment relative to the amount that you're borrowing, mm-hmm. but you can. Renovations, you can certainly do, but almost always when you're borrowing for renovations, you need to have had the property transferred over into your name. So let's say you're buying an existing property, like they call it a secondhand purchase, Yajnia. So once you've paid all the money by your down payment and the mortgage, and then a week or two later, by then your lawyer's already like taken off the previous owner's title, mm-hmm. you're now the registered owner, you can then borrow up again and take a second loan for the renovations. And it's a little bit more expensive, but not hugely expensive. So it's like two separate files.
So when you buy firsthand, new construction, once the property is completed and you've taken possession, can you then yeah. add another one for yeah. upgrades and, yeah. and renovations?
Yeah, you'd probably need to do an appraisal on the property, because firsthand properties don't usually need an appraisal.
Right.
Okay, so you'll buy the property. Let's say you bought it for 2 million shekel and you've got 50% mortgage, so you borrowed 1 million shekel.
Okay.
And now you want to take another 300 to renovate, mm-hmm. or whatever it may be. So at the point that you've completed the transaction, so you can get confirmation from the contractor that you've completed the transaction, mm-hmm. maybe from firsthand properties, it takes a long time for the registration to be completed. But there's usually a way to register a second charge at that point. So the bank will try to register an additional charge. They'll send an appraiser in. And assuming that you stay within the loan-to-value ratio limits, you know, so if like you bought for 2 million in my example and you took 1 million shekel mortgage. So if you want to go up to take another, let's say, 200,000 shekel, we want to see that the property is going to be worth 2.4, so mm-hmm. that you're at 50% loan-to-value ratio, assuming that that's your...
Right. And does the bank check that you're doing the construction work, that you're actually putting the money where you said you would be putting it?
Right. So often at times it works that they'll require it's called hatzat mechir, like a price quote from a contractor. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's enough and they'll just put the money into your account and goodbye. Sometimes they'll go half-half. They'll say, okay, like, well, you asked for 300,000 shekels, so we'll give you 150 now to get started. Mm-hmm. And then once you bring us like 150,000 shekel of receipts and proof of work, then we'll release the balance.
Right. I must say today, renovations in Israel are extremely expensive.
Yep.
It's very hard to find labor.
Yep.
And people are actually taking advantage of that.
Yeah.
And the cost of materials is
crazy
and just going up.
Yep.
Okay. So now for the next question. Is it possible mm-hmm. to consolidate multiple mortgages into one?
Mm. Depends. So as you know from the previous podcasts, it's very common in Israel for a loan to be broken into various tracks, mm-hmm. right? So let's say you took a 3 million shekel loan, you'll have 1 million fixed, 1 million variable, 1 million semi-fixed, something like that.
Okay.
And especially if, let's say, you're buying a first-hand property. So you might be releasing the mortgage in, you know, every 2 months. You know, you'll release a chunk of the mortgage every 2 months as the building.
What do you mean
by
release it? You mean,
in other words,
pay off?
When you get approved for a 3 million shekel mortgage, you might not take all the 3 million shekel in one go.
Oh, I see.
Right? As the construction goes, you might only draw down. Because if you take the full 3 million day one, you're going to be paying interest on the full 3 million. So you don't need to borrow it. You might just hold it. So what can happen with that is by the time you're finished, if you're releasing three loan tracks over five different releases, you end up with 15 different loan. You end up, by the time you're finished taking the loan, because you released it in five different stages and each stage is three different loan tracks, you can end up with like 15 different loan tracks. And it's very complicated when you actually know, 5 years later, you're looking at what do I actually owe?
And you don't remember.
You don't remember when you took it. What's the start date? Well, it depends. You know, I've got five different start dates on.
Right. And the rates probably change in that time as well.
And each one's got its own thing. So that can be, so for example, that's obviously an extreme example, but it happens. That actually happened to me, you know, when we bought our house, we released the money over stages. And, you know, by the time everything's done, got like 100 loan tracks. So sometimes it's worth it just, you know, if you have a situation like that, it can be worth it to keep it. Sometimes it's worth it to refinance just to, you know, make cedar, just to be able to understand what's going on with your mortgage. You can consolidate.
Okay, but this is all on the same property. What if someone has multiple properties, multiple mortgages? Can they consolidate?
Oh, right. Okay. So I actually, 2-3 days ago, I just had a guy who has four properties in Israel, small loans. Mm-hmm. Okay. One's at Bank Leumi, two at Bank Leumi, one's at Bank Mercantile, one's at Bank Mizrahi. And he's just...
All
over the place, exactly. So what he ended up doing was the property that was already leaned to Bank Mizrahi, the Bank Mizrahi already had a charge on, he just said, okay, so I'm going to take an extra loan, which is going to basically refinance all those loans from Leumi and Mercantile and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I've now got all my loans in one place against one property.
I see. But he still has four mortgages.
No, he has one mortgage now or two mortgages. He has one mortgage, which is like one big loan. Let's imagine he's taken now one new loan. Because when you refinance, what you're really doing is you're taking a new loan to pay off an old loan.
Right.
So if you take one 2 million shekel loan that pays off 500,000 shekel here, 300,000 shekel there, 1 million shekel there, you've now consolidated all those different loans into one. Mm-hmm. So you can do that. One sort of detail on that is in order to be able to do that, all the loans needed to have been initiated for the same purpose, because the bank prices risk. So a renovations loan is more expensive than a purchase loan. And a renovations loan is, let's say, cheaper than an all-purpose loan, halva lekol matara. So if all the loans are the same purpose, they can all be priced together into one new loan that pays it off. But
I see.
But if some of the loans are for renovation, let's say you've got, like in the previous question, if you have some of your mortgages for the purchase and some of the mortgages for renovation, those have to stay as two separate loans and they can't be mixed together.
Why is a renovation considered higher risk than a purchase?
It's a good question. So like, for example, an all-purpose loan. So the bank checks out the purpose of the loan.
What's an all-purpose loan?
So halva lekol matara. Let's say somebody wants to borrow against their house to, I don't know, invest in their business, mm-hmm. or to buy a property abroad, or let's say they're making a wedding. Okay. Now, that's a very common thing, to make a wedding. Mm-hmm. So the bank, an all-purpose loan, it sounds like the bank is saying, okay, we'll give you money for any kind of purpose. Like the bank checks what the purpose is, but assuming that it's not a standard thing like buying a house or renovating, it's called a halva'a lekol matara. Mm-hmm. It's a bit more expensive. And I guess the banks have their statisticians, and the bank says, you know, if somebody's borrowing for an all-purpose loan, the risk of default is X percent higher. You know, let's say out of 1,000 loans, five will foreclose instead of two.
Perhaps
will foreclose.
Because a home is like a stable basis.
When people take a loan and they're buying a house, they're very, very careful that, you know, this payment may bounce, or, you know, maybe the gun payment will bounce, but I'm going to make sure that my mortgage doesn't bounce. Because people feel very, you know, connected to the house.
Right.
When you're borrowing for renovations, so it's just that little bit more risky. It's like, oh, you're renovating, so why don't you have the cash to do it? So maybe there's a reason. So so again, I don't know what the numbers are, but let's say 98 out of 100 people who are borrowing for renovations are totally good for the money. But there's 2 out of 100 people who maybe shouldn't be borrowing to renovate, and maybe are not borrowing so responsibly. Yeah. And therefore the risk to the bank is higher, and therefore all of those loans get priced a little bit more expensively.
The all-purpose loan is a mortgage?
Yeah. So when I say mortgage, I mean a loan which is secured against a house. Because if you don't pay back the money, the bank, your house is at risk.
I see.
And it can be stretched over a long time. So it's secured. A loan which is secured against your house, I call a mortgage.
Okay. Going back to the idea of consolidating existing mortgages, my understanding is that every mortgage is backed by the property.
Yep.
So if you're consolidating multiple mortgages, which property are you backing it with? Or can you back it with multiple properties?
You can choose. I mean, it depends. I mean, no, every loan needs to be secured against one property. You can have two or three loans against one property.
That was my question.
You can't have one loan spread against
multiple properties.
In my example, what I was saying was that a guy who's got four properties and doesn't want to have his loan spread against four properties, he can take one loan against one property that refinances all
assuming
of those.
Assuming that the loans... The value of the loans are not
exactly
above the value
exactly
of the property.
Exactly.
Got it.
Exactly.
Okay. Another question that came to mind as we're talking, mm-hmm. when you refinance, I mean, we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago with Moshe Zak.
Yep.
As you said, you're basically taking a new loan. The old loan is closed. You never hear from it again. Or is it something that can like come up again later on, years later?
If you're refinancing all of the loan, so then the old loan is gone. But what can often happen is, right, I was just on a phone call with somebody this morning about this, that they have a loan which is broken into three loan tracks and two of them are terrible and one of them's great.
Mm.
So what he's actually doing is he's refinancing
two-thirds
of the loan.
Right.
So then what happens is that, you know, you have, so a third of the loan lives on and two-thirds of the loan gets wiped out and replaced by a new loan.
Interesting. Okay, but if you wipe out three-thirds, entire loan,
it's gone.
It's closed. Right. I mean, is there anything you have to do to make sure it's completely, you know, dead and buried?
No. What does it mean to refinance? To refinance means to take a new loan to pay off an old loan. So you can be pretty confident that when the bank issues the new loan, that money has gone to pay off the old loan. And what can happen if you're, let's say, switching banks, you know, if you took your first loan at Bank Leumi and then you're refinancing to Bank Hapoalim, so then you need to just make sure that, you know, when you're doing a refinance like that, you need to actually change the security. You need to like get involved in the legal side of things. You need to register a new mortgage from the new bank, Bank Hapoalim.
Okay, and who's responsible for all this?
Right, so mortgage brokers are coordinating with lawyers usually on something like that. So you need a little bit of help from a lawyer.
I see.
So what happens is, so when Bank Hapoalim pays off the loan, Bank Hapoalim literally transfers money to Bank Leumi.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you need to do is you need to make sure that once that's done, that within a month, Bank Leumi is obligated to release their charge from the property. Right. So you have to make sure that that's
done. What I'm thinking. Right? I mean, I like to know when something has been transferred over, and I like to receive in writing that we're closed, and I don't owe them any money,
right.
And no one's going to come back to me, however many years later, telling me I owe the money with interest.
Right. So you can call up the banks. It's called the Moked. You know, you call up the customer service.
Mm-hmm.
They should be sending you within 30 days a letter saying, you know, it's called Mismachei Bitul. Cancellation, you know, thank you, sure. You've paid us off in full, our charge has been released in the we no longer have a charge in the mortgage registry, we no longer have a charge in the land registry,
mm-hmm.
and these are all things that they have to do. Are there occasions where, you know, something falls through the cracks or there was a technical problem and you didn't know about it? You know, that can happen.
So
it's
sure.
it's worth it to make sure, especially if you've got a lawyer involved, you should, you know, make sure part of his job is that he follows up,
mm-hmm.
that the old charge has been completely removed and you've got a balance statement showing zero and, mm-hmm. you know,
okay.
And you're done.
Right, good. Okay, the next question is referring to Mechir L'Mishtaken,
mm-hmm.
which I'm just going to remind our listeners. We spoke about the very, very beginning of our podcast with, I think it was with Gedalia Borvik, when we spoke about the different ways in which people can buy or acquire property in Israel.
Right.
And one of the ways is there are some subsidized housing schemes run through the government, initiated by the government. One of the things that they've introduced in a way to tackle the rising prices and the housing crisis in Israel,
sure.
in particular for young couples and first-time buyers. The names have changed over the years. There was Mechir L'Mishtaken, Mechir L'Matara, Dira B'Hanacha, which I think it is now. Agents and people working in the free market are not generally involved in this. We're not allowed to be. It's all done through a government website. Mm-hmm. You basically enter yourselves and it's a lottery. And there's an algorithm to work out who wins, but different people have higher chances of winning depending on where they grew up. If they're applying for an apartment in an area that they live or that they grew up and spent in several years, then their chances, I believe, are higher than those who don't live in that area. Okay, so that was a brief introduction to Mechir L'Mishtaken. Somebody is asking, are there any specific benefits or conditions for Mechir L'Mishtaken buyers?
Right. So from the point of view of mortgages, there's definitely a big one, which is, I mean, again, these...
Of course, related to mortgages,
So these numbers, the exact numbers change, but basically the principle is like this. The maximum loan-to-value ratio that a bank is willing and is allowed to lend, according to the Bank of Israel, is 75%. Okay,
so for that, people living in Israel,
for people living in Israel, first time buyers, that's the maximum.
Okay.
Okay. So, what's special about Mechila Mishtaken is that you're buying the property at a discount. So I'll just give you some rough numbers, right? So let's say you're buying a property which is market value is, let's say, 1.2. But because it's Mechila Mishtaken, it's sold at a discount. So it's sold at, let's say, 1 million shekel. So the banks say, we're going to do the maximum loan-to-value ratio of 75%. Based upon what it's worth, not based upon what you paid for it.
Fantastic.
So what that means is that if you paid for it 1 million shekel and it's worth 1.2, so you're getting, it's a little complicated, but you're getting 75% of 1.2, which is really 900,000 shekel.
As opposed to 750.
Which is 90%. So you're getting 90% mortgage. That's the key thing. You're getting a 90% mortgage on a property based on what you bought. It's 90% relative to what you paid for it.
Right.
And it's 70, and from the bank's point of view, they don't mind because it's 75% of what it's worth.
Right. That makes sense because if, God forbid, they default, the bank can sell the property
exactly
for 1.2.
Exactly. So the bank's not taking any additional risk. The bank's not saying, well, we're going to lend that much more than the property's worth. So it's a kind of win-win. You're getting the buyer gets the discount. The bank gives the same loan that it would have given had it been bought at the true price.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the idea of it.
And you can,
it's limited though. I think the maximum today is 1.35 million. In other words, for any property which is worth 1.8 million shekel, you can get 75% of 1.8, which is 1.35 million shekel.
Mm-hmm.
That's the maximum. So if you bought a property worth 1.85 for 1.5,
you'll still get the same.
You'll get exactly. You can get up to 1.35 million shekel
and 90% buyers, finance. Qualified buyers can borrow from any bank in Israel.
Exactly. Yeah. So the Mechila Mishtaken is not limited. Every bank can do Mechila Mishtaken. And as long as you're quote unquote, good for the money, they'll lend it to you.
Beautiful. Okay. Let's talk about guarantors now.
Mm.
Do you need guarantors when taking out a mortgage in Israel? First of all, what are guarantors?
Right. So there's a guarantor and there's a co-signer. There's a slight difference in legal terms. But basically the idea is, but by default, you don't need a guarantor or a co-signer. If you're borrowing a loan, and you've got the income to show that you can service the loan, which basically you're earning 3 times the monthly repayment, then mm-hmm. you're good for the loan and you don't need to get involved with guarantors or co-signers.
Okay.
What happens if your income's not strong enough? Okay, let's say your monthly repayment is 5,000 shekel and you only earn 8,000 shekel a month. So the bank says, well, that's a large monthly repayment.
Well, I thought they'll, it's not only fit lend, in your budget. They'll only lend you if you're up to 40% of your monthly
exactly.
income.
Exactly. So let's say you don't meet the requirements. If you don't meet the requirement, what you can do is you can get a guarantor or a co-signer. Now, a guarantor or a co-signer means you get somebody who is a close blood relative, which means if you're young, it means a parent. Mm-hmm. If you're older, very old, on the older side of the scale, it means a child mm-hmm. or a sibling.
Let's say for a young couple who are buying who are still students.
Yeah.
Their income is going to increase,
exactly.
But for now they won't qualify.
Exactly. So parents can be guarantors or co-signers and they're signing on the loan. And basically it means if, God forbid, the kids can't make the monthly repayments. Mm-hmm. So the guarantor or the co-signer stands behind it. And if ultimately even the guarantor or the co-signer can't sign, refuses to carry on paying, then, the house is at risk.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a way that the banks feels confident to lend the money, that they've got somebody else signed on, that we're sort of piggybacking on their income. It happens much, the classic case of guarantors and co-signers is young couples.
Yeah.
A young couple hasn't got the income just yet. Mm-hmm. And the parents are still young enough that they can help out and are happy to help out. So
Can guarantors have their name removed at any point in the future?
So first of all, most cases, guarantors and co-signers are not on the title of the property, mm-hmm. right? They're not co-buyers. Sometimes right. they could be co-buyers as well. Sometimes okay. if the bank really wants them to bound into the deal, they'll say, we want you to own 5% of the property too. But that doesn't happen so commonly. So they're on the mortgage. Usually what happens is that the co-signer is kind of just, if it's going well, it's going well and people just forget about it. But if kids feel like, I don't really want my parents being involved in, we took this when I was 25 and now I'm 35 and my parents are still on it. You can either get them removed, mm-hmm. If your income situation is there, or you can just refinance the loan and start again, you know, get a new loan, pay off the old loan.
What about if a guarantor dies? Does the bank come and ask for another one?
I mean, the bank's usually not notified, as far as I know. But what can happen is one of the requirements, meaning the bank thinks about that in advance. And the bank's what the bank says, well, if we're, let's say it's an older cosigner or somebody like that, so the bank may require that the cosigner takes life insurance, right? So a default requirement at the banks, if you're borrowing money from the bank by default, you can get waivers, but the bank's default requirement is, we want you to have a life insurance policy.
Yeah, we discussed that.
You went through
but
exactly.
That's on the buyer. Now so you're saying even the guarantor may need
to. So guarantors and cosigners are not exactly the same thing. A cosigner is like a primary borrower, and a guarantor is slightly less. Okay. Guarantors do not require life insurance. Cosigners
may.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple more questions that are just coming to mind as we're talking. Guarantors that live overseas. A young couple buying, they made Aliyah on their own, the parents still live abroad. Can the parents be the guarantors?
Right. So that would be more of a case of a cosigner. Guarantor, that's usually the bank would require a cosigner. There are some banks who will not allow cosigners who are foreign residents.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some who do, and that's really all you need. As long as you've got some.
Right. And I'm assuming it comes at a price.
Well, it depends. If the cosigner is very, very strong, so from the point of view of the bank, they're saying, well, listen, you know, we've actually, our risk profile may be less with a super duper cosigner who's a first line borrower.
I see.
Relative to, you know, just the random person who's maybe not as strong. But because you've got a limited range of banks, every situation where you've got a limited range of banks, it also limits your ability to negotiate.
Sure.
So if you haven't got as much, if I can't say to the bank, unless you give me an excellent price, I'm going to bank B, C, D down around the corner. So that has an impact on the price.
Sure. Okay. And now another question on this topic about a cosigner. I remember, I think it was Yehudit Margalit a few weeks ago mentioned that today we're seeing a lot of people approaching retirement or in retirement who are making Aliyah. They are not eligible, or they're too old to take a long mortgage. So they're getting their kids to be cosigners.
Right.
Right. But the question is like this: if someone acts as a cosigner on a mortgage, will it affect their borrowing chances in the future?
Yes, it does. So that's why it's always best to avoid it, especially with kids. It's best to avoid it. So you can get a mortgage until the age of 85. So if you're
85.
Yeah. So if you're making Aliyah, and you're 75, you can still get a 10-year mortgage. Uh-huh. I've even gone false approved till the age of 90. I've gone false approved to the age of 90 without life insurance.
Wow.
So
based upon other assets?
Just based upon income. And sometimes the bank, sometimes you can just, you know, the people at the other end of the bank, it's human beings. And sometimes you can just push it. And sometimes things just go through that you never thought could go through.
Amazing.
So, yeah, so I've done mortgages at the age of 90. And it's so much less complicated than involving kids, because then kids, because exactly as you're saying, if the kids have now got a mortgage on their name that they've got to worry about. So from the point of view of the bank, some of their income is like tied up in their commitment to their parents' mortgage. And so if they want to borrow for themselves or for their kids,
right,
it can be a problem. So I would definitely, if you're in that situation, I would definitely try the utmost to push the limits of how far you can take the loan. Go till 90 if you can.
Avoid the cosigners.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, we have a few questions that came in on leveraging the property equity.
Yep.
So can I take equity out of my property in Israel, and under what circumstances?
Right.
Why don't you explain, first of all, what does it mean to take equity? Let's discuss that.
Right. So let's talk numbers. Let's talk about, so imagine a person has a house. The house is worth 3 million shekel, and they have only a half a million shekel mortgage secured against that. Okay, mm-hmm. So that means that they've got an asset worth. So they've got, let's say, an asset worth 3 with, I think in our example, it's half a million shekel of debt. That means they've got 2.5 million shekel of equity in the property. Okay. Now, what that means is, now, that's money that you can't access. You can't turn your house into cash. Unless you sell it, exactly. So if you sell the property, now I've got a load of cash and no house.
Right.
So is there a way to get cash and house? So that's called an equity release. Okay. So that's a way to get money from the bank. You go to the bank and you say, I'd like to borrow money. I'd like to secure it against the property. That's called an equity release mortgage.
How's that different from, we spoke before about an all-purpose loan?
Right. So an all-purpose loan is an equity release mortgage.
I see.
So all-purpose. So the question is, when you're doing equity release, What is the purpose of the loan? Now, what used to be very common, and the bankers clamped down on it, is I would borrow up against property A as a down payment on property.
Well, that's my next question. My next question is, can I borrow against my first property exactly. to buy a second property?
Exactly. So it used to be that was very common. And the Bank of Israel said, you can't do that anymore.
In Why? Other words,
you can't. So the entire real estate industry here, in terms of tax and in terms of loan to value ratios and all the rules, are basically set up to make it as easy as possible for your average Israeli who lives here to buy one house. Mm-hmm. Anybody who doesn't live here or who lives here and wants to buy second property two, property three, property four, anything that basically works towards driving up the prices of houses for young couples, they make harder. They tax them higher. They give them, make it harder for them to borrow a higher loan to value ratio. And this is another piece, you know, another tool in the toolbox of the Bank of Israel saying we don't want people building property portfolios here in Israel. Or if they're doing it, we want to make it as difficult as possible for them to do so. Mm-hmm. So there are ways around that. If you want me to get into it, I can. What you can do is...
So one second, sorry.
Yeah.
It used to be that you could borrow against your home and buy a second property.
Yeah,
so that 2.5 million shekel equity
right.
that you had, you could say, I'll take that out and buy another apartment.
You can't take 100% borrowing. So let's
take
say you
want to
take 50. Yeah. So let's say I'll take 1 million shekel out. I'll do an equity release. I'll take out 1 million shekel. Mm-hmm. I'll use that as a down payment on property two. Mm-hmm. Buy, let's say, for 2 million. So I'll borrow, get 1 million cash, so to speak, from the first property.
Right.
Borrow another 1 million against the second property. And now I've basically not put down too much cash.
Right. You know, and that can go on forever. You can do that multiple times.
Until you run out of equity. But yeah, exactly.
Right.
And
okay.
That's a very common thing.
And that
real estate people
how long
do.
Ago?
2 years, give or take. I don't remember exactly. Don't hold me to that. I think it was, something
okay.
like
and
2 years
now what?
Ago.
And now what?
So now, if you go to the bank and you say, I want to borrow against property A, a 30-year loan, I want to pull out 1 million shekel in order to buy property B, they say, you can't do it. You're stuck. So you have to basically get creative in terms of what the purpose of the loan is that works within the regulations. Now, what you can do is you're allowed to buy what's called dira chalifit. Dira chalifit means that you're, again, like we said, you only, Bank of Israel is happy for you to have one property only. But what happens if you don't have to sell your house in order to buy another house. Mm-hmm. Maybe let's say I want to buy, let's call it property two, with the intention of selling property A within a relatively short time.
That's not an investment, then. That's to replace your home.
Right. So the bank will allow you to borrow under those terms. It's called a dira chalifit. Mm-hmm. So you can do short-term borrowing. Now, what people do is they can take a short-term loan and if they change their mind and they then say, it turns out property two is really not something which we can... You know, it turns out we don't want to sell property one. And
right.
property two is actually...
Or we can't sell property one.
Yeah, exactly. Or we can't. Or for whatever reason, the situation may change. You can then refinance that loan to long-term borrowing. So it's kind of like a bit of a loophole that sometimes gets you around some of the regulations. But the idea behind this rule is that, you can't... What you can do is you could also borrow the costs. You know, let's say you're buying property two. Property two's got 13%. Transaction costs. You've got 8% purchase tax and a lawyer and a realtor and a this and a that. Mm-hmm. So you can borrow up against property one for the costs, and you can borrow up against property one to get the ball rolling if it's a dira chalifit, if it's a replacement property, which you might change your mind on and make it not a replacement property. You can borrow up for the renovations of property two. But there are all kinds of, like, just sort of painting the picture that it's harder to pull out money in a straightforward way from the bank in order to build a portfolio, mm-hmm. which is much more harder than it used to be.
Right. One of the questions that we had was about this, buying a second property to replace the first property.
Mm.
And we had learned in one of the previous episodes that you basically are committing to sell. You can get a 70% loan to value mortgage if you commit to sell the first property within 18
Correct.
Months. What happens if you take that 70% loan and then after 18 months, you haven't sold, or you, as you said, choose not to sell, or you cannot sell? What do you do?
So the commitment isn't to the bank. The bank looks at it like this. We are able, the bank say, I'm speaking from them in the name of the bank for a minute. The bank says like this. We can lend 70% if you've made a declaration to the tax authority when you made when you bought this property, that this is considered to be a dira khalifit, a replacement property. Mm-hmm. So we'll see when you report the transaction, you've reported it in that way, you've made that commitment to the tax authority. So if you've done that, then we as the bank are quite happy to lend you a 30-year loan for 70%, mm-hmm. no more questions. If after 18 months, you're not in a position for whatever reason to meet your commitment, so to speak, to the tax authority, you are now obligated to go back to the tax authority and say, I can no longer make that commitment. I need to change my categorization of the purchase. You're probably going to send me a whopping bill for tax, mm-hmm. and I'll deal with it. But from the bank's point of view, they don't, but Asher Husham, you know, at that time, mm-hmm. you had mm-hmm. bought this property as a dira khalifit. Mm-hmm. We've issued you a loan on that basis. There's no backseats. Okay. We don't have to.
Okay, on to the next topic, Aaron. We've had a couple of questions about income and affordability.
Yep.
So firstly, how does the bank calculate income for mortgage approval?
So it depends how... So first of all, we're talking about personal income. So in other words, if you, let's say you own a company and you're making millions of dollars and all that money is sitting in the company, but you're not personally drawing that money out of the company, that doesn't count, in at least in a foreign company. It does it if it's an Israeli company, but okay. my clientele is often more of a, it's often more likely foreign company. So it needs to be money that you personally have earned. Mm-hmm. So they'll look at your pay stubs, they'll look at your tax returns. Your tax returns have got income from all kinds of sources, capital gains or rental income or so on and so forth.
Pension,
absolutely. Parental support for younger couples, sometimes. That's a bit of a grey area. Sometimes okay. you can include parental support. Rent, as we said. And they put all that together.
Mm-hmm. Passive income?
Passive income is absolutely fine. Yep. Dividends mm-hmm. income, if you're pulling a dividend from a company, mm-hmm. That's fine. As I say, capital gains, if you, let's say you've got stocks in a... You've got a stock portfolio when you're taking... You know, you have to declare your profits each year. So that's mm-hmm. that's income. It shows up on your tax returns. From both spouses as well, mm-hmm. okay? And the bank turns that into a post-tax monthly number. So it puts all that together and let's say, I don't know, it adds up to, let's say, 24,000 shekel, okay? So the bank says like this, we can give you a monthly repayment, which is up to 40% of that number, mm-hmm. okay? Now you also have to take off, let's say you've got 24,000 shekel of net monthly income, but you've also got a 2,000 shekel car loan. So you have to take that off as well. So you're mm-hmm. down to 22. And right. then you've got a bank loan of 500 shekel a month. Now you're down to whatever it is, 21 and a half. But once the bank establishes that number, so it's up to 40% is what your monthly repayment can be. And then you calculate backwards.
Along the same lines, I think you answered it, but I'm just going to make sure it's covered. Can I include profits held in a company as part of my income?
Right. So if it's an Israeli company, yes. And if it's a foreign company, no. Mm-hmm. I actually spoke to the CEO of Bank Mizrahi about this. It's a Bank of Israel regulation. We had a round table about a month ago and they were saying like, what can we do to make things better? And I said, like, this is an absolutely crazy situation that you have very, very wealthy people who have companies that they own 100% with mm-hmm. earning lots and lots of money. But as long as that money is held in a company, isn't drawn down and taxes paid on it, they just don't calculate the income. So
unbelievable.
It's not it's crazy. But crazy. There you go.
Okay. So these are the facts.
Yeah.
Okay. I probably should have asked this one at the very beginning. Somebody's saying, can you explain what LTV is and how it's calculated? Because this is a term that's been coming up, the loan-to-value ratio we mentioned throughout, and I feel bad we should have addressed it at the very beginning. What exactly is it?
Right. So LTV, loan to value. So value means the value of your property. Okay.
The value of your property today or when you bought it?
The value of the property when you're taking the loan.
Got it. Okay.
So so let's say for argument's sake.
Refinancing.
Right. So it depends. So I'll explain. So loan to value ratio means how much is the bank lending relative to the value of your property. So that's actually really important. If let's say, again, let's just talk numbers. So you're buying a property for 1 million shekel and you've got let's say 75% loan to value, which is the maximum. So the bank's lending you 75% of 1 million shekel. That's 750,000 shekel. Mm-hmm. So the bank says, how do we establish the value of the property? Is it just because what you paid for it? So the bank says, we're going to send an appraiser down.
We had an appraiser come in. We know all about that.
Yeah.
But okay.
Okay. So as long as so it will be the lower of the two. The bank establishes the value based on either the purchase price or the mm-hmm. value of or the appraisal value, the lower of the two. So okay. That's how you establish loan to value. So if you, let's say, bought a first-hand property 3 years ago, mm-hmm. And now's when you're getting your keys and you need to complete. So the bank establishes the value based on the contract price, not based on its value today.
I see. And if you refinance?
So, but if you're refinancing, let's say you're pulling money out of the property, or you've, or like in our earlier example, let's say I've paid for the house and now I want to do renovations.
Right.
So now I'm doing renovations today. So it's not based on, we're not interested in what you paid it's for originally. We're based house. On the value of the house today. Okay. So depending on the type of the loan, depends on the date of the value, which sets the loan to value ratio.
Got
if that
it,
makes
got
sense.
It. Got it. What is the maximum LTV ratio I can get?
Right. So we mentioned, so from banks, the maximum for a first-time buyer, Israeli resident, you don't have to be a citizen. First-time buyer, somebody who lives in Israel, is 75%. And you can get 75% if you're an Israeli first-time buyer not living in Israel as well. If you're an Israeli citizen but not living there, you can get 75%. There are ways to borrow, like from secondary lending. You know, you can theoretically go over the 75%. You'll get 75% from the bank.
A lot of people have asked, is there any way to get more than 50% as an investor or get more than 75% as an Israeli resident?
Right. So it's a great question. So so there's like the in theory and there's the in practice. So in theory, you can take secondary lending. In other words, you'll go to the bank, which means primary lending. You'll go to a bank and they'll give you, let's say, 50% financing, because that's what the laws say. And then you can go to another outside, a non-bank lender, and put a second charge on the property. I want another 20% or another 30%. You can do that. In practice, it's very expensive. And people don't like it. So at least my clientele don't like it. So if you go to them and you say, okay, here's 50% financing for 30 years at 5%. Okay, that's not bad. That sounds like a nice deal. And then you go and you say, okay, there's a secondary lender and they're charging 12% or 11% or whatever it is. They say, oh, I'll find another way. So people don't tend to do that. But what they do tend to go for is what I mentioned earlier, which is the halavah b'cheshbon, which is when you're taking a mortgage, you need to open a bank account. When you open a bank account, you might just get an unsecured loan for 10, 12 years. And that's relatively easy. You can always pay it off. You don't have to register second charges.
But it's more expensive.
It's more expensive and it's short term, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I guess I know the answer to this, but you can only take one mortgage on any property, correct?
You mean from one lender?
Yeah, right.
No, you can take more. It's just that you need, if you've got, let's say you've borrowed money from one lender and yep. then you want to borrow from a second lender.
On the same.
Yeah, it's called Darga Shnia.
But then which bank has got the house as a security?
Right. So in order to register what's called Darga Shnia, which means a second charge, mm-hmm. so bank two needs to get documents from bank one saying it's called Haskamala Darga Shnia. They get permission to give a second charge. And you can definitely do that.
You can do that.
Yeah. Let's say you've got an awesome mortgage from Bank Leumi that you don't want to get rid of, but now you want to borrow secondary borrowing from Bank Hapoalim, and Bank Hapoalim are the best bank for this particular situation. So you just need to get Bank Leumi to permit, who is Darga Rishona, mm-hmm. their first charge, they need to get the second bank to give permission.
I see. Can I take a mortgage abroad to purchase a property in Israel?
Right. So there's two different ways of answering that. So you can take a... Let's say, for example, let's say you're making aliyah. Mm-hmm. So you've got a house in America and you want to take a line of credit from that house in America in order to give you the cash to start a down payment on a property in Israel. That you can do. So I don't get it. I'm an Israeli mortgage broker. That's not my end of the my end of the deal. But you'll speak to your US or your UK mortgage broker mm-hmm. and they'll take care of it on that end. That's a very common thing. And then when you make aliyah or you sell your house, you'll pay off the loan in the US.
I guess that's
US.
Like what we call an all-purpose loan, but it's...
It's an equity release loan against your house in America. So you can certainly do that. You sometimes get things going the other way, which is, let's say... you know, I see this amazing investment opportunity for a very cheap property in America or in the UK or whatever it is, and I've got my expensive property in Israel, mm-hmm. which is sitting there with no mortgage. So sometimes people will take a mortgage against their Israeli property in order to buy property abroad. Mm-hmm. You know, usually it's for investments, but it can be...
The security would be the property in Israel, not the property abroad.
Exactly.
So it's more of a loan.
So that would be an equity release loan for from an Israeli mortgage bank. And the purpose of the loan, it's an all-purpose loan, and the purpose of the loan is foreign investment in real estate.
I see. What sort of rates would you get on that in comparison to the regular mortgage rates?
About 2% more expensive.
I see. Which is still cheaper than taking a loan.
Sometimes it works. You know, you never know. Sometimes it's only a short-term loan. Sometimes, you know, people do investments that they need the money for 2-3 years and then they sell and they move on. So sometimes it's worth it to pay the premium.
Right. Somebody's asking, what is a dragging mortgage and when is it useful?
Grera. So dragging the mortgage. So a loan. So what's a mortgage? A mortgage is a loan which is secured against a property.
Okay.
Let's say you want to sell the property, but you want to keep the mortgage. Why would I want to do that? So let's say, for example, let's say I fixed in 2021 when rates were super low. Mm-hmm. So I want to keep that loan. And when I buy another property, I'll move the mortgage onto the new property. So Grirat Mashkanta means that I am keeping the existing, I'm not changing the loan terms, I'm not refinancing. It's the exact same loan as it always was. Mm-hmm. But what I'm doing is I'm changing the security. So instead of it being secured against property A, I'm now doing Grera, I'm dragging it. I'm moving it from property A to property B.
I see.
And if property B doesn't exist, you can also do Grirat Mashkanta and you can secure it against the sale proceeds. So let's say you sell the house. You put the sale proceeds in deposit,
okay,
and the mortgage is secured against that cash. And then when it's time to, and then when you find a place to buy, you buy the property and you move the
mortgage
over.
And you're not paying repayments until you have another property.
No, you are. You still owe interest, but so it's not a good. I mean, you're making a very good point,
you're paying interest on
a loan. You're paying interest on a loan with no.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's as a short term stopgap, it can be worth it. I mean, I wouldn't do this for years and years.
I see.
But sometimes if you've got a great rate of interest, you know, it adds up to hundreds of thousands of shekels over over the term. It's worth it.
And someone is asking, what is a balloon loan?
Mm. So balloon loan is just another way of saying interest only. I mean, the way it's called a balloon loan because, you know, you're paying only the interest and there's no capital repayments. And then the final payment is, you know, the balloon pops.
I see.
And then you've got to give back all the money in that final payment. So,
it's basically,
yeah, exactly, when the balloon pops. Mm-hmm. So in other countries, you can do that for like 20 years, 30 years. You can do a long-term interest-only loan. In Israel, they don't allow it. You can do a short-term, you know, a couple of years, a couple of years interest-only. Let's say, for example, it's very common for people who are making aliyah and like they know that they're going to sell their house and pay off the mortgage but you know, in other words, if they've got a house in America, they're going to, when they sell their house, they'll have enough money to pay off all their borrowing.
Right.
But they're not selling their house yet. So they'll get a little bit of cash together for the deposit. They'll take an interest-only loan for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever it is, 5 years even you can do. Sometimes you can push it to 10 years, but it's quite hard. Mm-hmm. 3 to 5 years is normal. And then they know that they're just going to be paying the interest. They don't have to make any capital repayments. And there's a very clear exit strategy. You know, when they make aliyah, they'll sell the house, they'll get the cash, and they'll use it to pay off the loan. So that's the way they prevent the balloon from bursting and you owe suddenly
millions. I see. So it's not actually a mortgage. Or is
it's a mortgage loan. It's, in other words, it's a loan secured against a property in Israel. Mm-hmm. It's just that the repayment terms are interest only and then a final payment of everything.
Got it. Okay.
A normal mortgage is a little bit of capital and a little bit of interest each month. And so by the time you get to the final monthly repayment, you don't owe the bank anything.
Mm-hmm.
In this way, you're just paying interest and the amount that you owe the bank doesn't change. It's
understand.
The same amount.
Yeah. Right. So talking about people making aliyah, is it worth taking the special aliyah mortgage and what are the pros and cons?
So I generally don't bother. So the special aliyah mortgage, you can get approximately 100,000 to 120,000 shekel of your overall loan if you qualify for a special aliyah mortgage at special preferential terms. So the interest rate is a bit lower than you can get on the market.
Mm-hmm.
And the big advantage of it is that there's no prepayment. It's a fixed rate and no prepayment penalties. It's the only loan product where you can fix the interest and not have any prepayment penalties for sure when you pay off the loan. So that's the advantage of it. The disadvantage of it is that it's index linked. So, you know, I'm sure you had in previous podcasts, you spoke about Samud Lamadad, an index linked loan.
Sure.
So a slightly better rate with indexation, it's probably not better than just getting a normal mortgage and moving on.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Okay. I'm not sure if this is your specialty, but we're going to try. Are there mortgage related tax benefits in Israel? How can borrowers maximize tax benefits?
So the tax that I care about most is purchase tax. Okay, so that's in other words the tax that you pay as a result of buying the property. Mm-hmm. So that the experts on that, it's funny, it's not really accountants, it's lawyers. Mm-hmm. So real estate lawyers are the people who advise you.
We had two episodes dedicated to Mas Rechisha. We have had actually a few accountants come on over the last few months. We had a US tax advisor and a UK tax advisor talk about the tax implications of owning, buying and selling property in Israel.
Right.
And then we had an Israeli accountant and a US CPA, Hannah Engel, who spoke about the tax requirements and the reporting requirements related to renting property here in Israel. And we did speak about the options of reporting the interest for mortgages.
At the end of the year, when your accountant does your taxes, they'll probably ask you for a mortgage statement. And that's, you know, I get that throughout the whole year, especially around tax time. People mm-hmm. ask me for it, you know, can you just help me get the mortgage statement so I can see how much interest I paid? You give it to your accountant. Your accountant does
and,
the magic.
And if anyone's interested, they should go back to the episode with Hannah Engel, and she talks about the various different options that are out there. Some include the mortgage payments, the interest payments, and some don't.
Right.
Okay. Aaron, thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure.
You've shared a tremendous amount of expertise. You've answered a lot of the questions. There were more, but we can't do all of it today. But I'm sure we could go on for hours tackling more questions. We'll have to call it a day for now. Before we wrap up, I have to ask you two questions that I ask all my guests. Where in Israel do you live and why did you choose it?
Oh, I live in Ramat Bet Shemesh. Ramat Bet Shemesh is just a beautiful community for Anglos. People say it's a little bit of an Anglo bubble, but it's a place where there's a nice range of religious shades, and I think a lot of people find their niche there. And also, it's a lot. I started off in Yerushalayim. Property is a lot more expensive in Yerushalayim than it is in Ramat Bet Shemesh. It's actually Bet Shemesh has caught up a lot, which is nice. But it was more affordable, and just there's a beautiful community there. Beautiful shuls, beautiful schools.
Fantastic, beautiful. If you were to move to another place in the country, Aaron, where would you go?
Should I confer with
and
my wife?
Why? Absolutely not. I want to hear what you have to say.
I think I would move somewhere. The one of the beautiful things about Bet Shemesh is it doesn't take long to go out into the country. So maybe I'd like just in my fancy land go to live on a moshav or something like
that. Oh, lovely, yeah. Lovely, beautiful.
You know, we live in such a beautiful country that the moshav life is so awesome.
More open,
yeah,
green.
Exactly.
Beautiful.
Exactly.
Okay.
Different from London.
One day, you never know. Aaron, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing so much valuable insight with our listeners today. I also want to take this opportunity to thank all of the incredible guests that have joined us throughout this season, graciously sharing their professional knowledge, their insights, and time. Your contributions have been invaluable, and we are so grateful for the wisdom you bring to all of our listeners. And to our audience, if you have any further questions, you can find Aaron's contact information in the show notes, as you can for all of our previous guests this season. I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us throughout this journey. I hope you've learned, enjoyed, and now feel confident and ready to take your next steps towards securing a mortgage and purchasing your home in Israel. At the end of the day, this is what it's all about, familiarizing you with the terms, concepts, and processes so that you can go ahead and make informed decisions at the right time. And please God, find your way home. We're going to take a short break now that the season has ended, but please God, we'll be back very soon with more on The House. Thank you for listening and see you next season. Thank you for listening to On The House. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe and share it with your family and friends. You can also visit buyitinisrael.com, where you can find news, market updates, guidance, and much more on real estate in Israel. That's buyitinisrael.com. If you have a question or a specific topic you'd like us to cover on this podcast, please email us at the address you'll find at the bottom of the show notes. Whether you're thinking about Aliyah, looking for a home or a haven, or wanting to support the Israeli economy, now is the time to buy it in Israel.